With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. And welcome to part two of this week's Clash. On Monday's episode, we had a hell of a time aboard the Event Horizon. And today, we're turning up the heat on board the Icarus 2 on its mission to reignite the sun and save humankind. Because from 2006, we're basking in sunshine.
16 months ago, I, Robert Capa, and a crew of seven left Earth frozen in a solar winter. Our mission, reignite the sun before it's too late. Welcome to Icarus 2. So if you wake up one morning and it's a particularly beautiful day, you'll know we made it.
We'll have a winner at the end of the show, but which film will it be? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken.
Hello, Clash Putters. For 7 years, I spoke to God. He told me to take you all to heaven. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilly.
We are recording remotely today, just a warning, I guess, in case things start to behave weirdly. That's why. But, you know, we'll power through. And very quickly, that bit that I say at the start of the second show every week that I hope you listen to. But if you don't, that's fine. But if you do, it's really useful. If you could subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify or other. And if indeed that platform allows you to give us a little rating or even a review, it's so useful. and really appreciate it. So if you could do that, that would be great. Another quick reminder, all January, we are doing Clash Podder picks. These are pairings that you have picked for us to put up against each other. Christopher, who gave us this incredible pairing of my darling Event Horizon and this movie Sunshine?
Not one, not two, but three people suggested this pairing, and that was Samantha, Tom, and Imran.
Thank you, Samantha, Tom, and Imran. I got to talk about Event Horizon on Monday, so I can pretty much leave the show happy now. But I'm going to stick around. Shall we get straight into this? Because I did Event Horizon. Chris, you've been gifted Sunshine, so why don't you begin by taking us on a journey?
Our sun is dying. The planet faces extinction. So we sent a crew into space with a bomb designed to create a star within a star to save humanity. But they disappeared. So now we're sending another crew with another bomb. These eight astronauts, who are very brave and very good looking, face moral quandaries and have frequent philosophical debates in a film that asks big questions about science and religion and the worth of one life versus the survival of many. Then Mark Strong turns out the lights and chases women around a spaceship with a knife at the end.
Oh, it's such a different ending to the rest of the film.
So Vicky, let's start with you. Did you think that Sunshine took place on a submarine?
Now, I thought I'd seen it, but I thought it was set on the moon. No, I have seen it. I have seen it. I can't remember when, but I did see it at home. And I was excited to watch it again. And I think I enjoyed it more a second time.
Interesting. Alex, how about you?
Yeah, Victoria and I concur. I watched this ages ago and was like, don't like this. Didn't like it. Not my thing, not my cup of tea at all. And then I watched it at the weekend, and I'm a big Event Horizon fan. I dare say that this film possibly scared me a bit more in a different way, not visceral scares, but after it had finished, I was left feeling rather uncomfortable for quite a long time afterwards. And every time I closed my eyes, I could see Mark Strong's face, possibly even more than you can see it in the film.
Yeah, you can't really see it in the film. You can see his fucking arm come off. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, no, but it's those eyes. You know, like they do the video message like they do in Event Horizon, except this one, like instead of the hell orgy, it's just him sort of like distorted looking at the camera with that sort of like, you can just see his eye. That freaked me out a lot.
Interesting. So I don't think it's any secret that I'm a huge Danny Boyle fan. So I asked to cover this one for work. So I went and saw an early screening of it. And then I went to interview Danny Boyle, who is my very favourite person to interview, and Brian Cox, Professor Brian Cox, who hadn't been on the telly.
I've never mentioned that before. He's not been on the telly when you saw him.
No. So basically the exciting thing was the bloke from D-Ream is now a scientist. That's what we were all talking about while we were waiting to speak to him.
Yeah.
So I think this was kind of a launch pad to actually him getting TV work. Was he did a lot of press for this film. He was obviously the scientific advisor on this one.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was. I was just excited to speak to the guy from D-Ream at the time, to be honest.
Danny Boyle was saying, because he hadn't hit big, there's a really funny interview with Danny Boyle, because obviously we all know who Brian Cox is now. It's like the wonder of the universe. But at the time, like, he was like this sort of like, it was the fact that there was a guy who was going around making science cool for people. Even in the press tour for this film, and I think he was going to schools and basically removing this idea that science is men with beards in white coats holding test tubes. And actually, you know, it could be someone who once told us things can only get better.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have the foggiest what he was telling me, but he was very nice and very pretty. So, so it was exciting to meet those guys. And Brian Cox even does a commentary on the DVD of this, just an isolated Brian Cox commentary. Which I couldn't be asked to listen to, but I did listen to the Danny Boyle one, so I will have some bits and pieces from that. Should we do a bit of history of the film then?
Yeah.
It's written by Alex Garland, who obviously wrote The Beach that Danny Boyle adapted and then collaborated with him on 28 Days Later, which we've previously done. And Alex was inspired by an article he read in an American periodical that speculated about what would happen should the sun die.
That's a word that Brian Cox would never use. You see, I'm already like, ugh, periodical. Brian Cox would go, in this amazing pamphlet, a really sexy pamphlet. Periodical, don't use it, boring.
What Garland said, what interested me was the idea that it could get to a point when the entire planet's survival rests on the shoulders of one man and what that would do to his head.
I'm already annoyed. Why wouldn't it be one person? Why wouldn't it be one person? Sorry, let's just get this done now. That obviously annoys the living shit out of me. Why man? You, why not person? Why not human?
Well, Vicky, have you watched the film? It was one man, so...
I know. And this is obviously jumping ahead massively, but it annoyed me there as well. It's like, God will talk to one man, one human, Mark Strong.
So Danny Boyle, Alex Garland was interested in this story. He went away and wrote a script and then met with Danny Boyle in a pub on Tottenham Court Road at Christmas 2004.
Oh, there's not very nice pubs on Tottenham Court Road. Surely they could have picked somewhere else. A lot of them are full of UCL students. I used to drink in them. And if I'd seen Brian Cox or Danny Boyle in there and I was full of aftershock, I'd have been right over there going, fucking... Danny Boyle, I love Chainspotting. Hey!
Alex gave Danny a 90-page script, and Danny Boyle said the concept was quite small. For instance, at the end of the film, the two remaining guys were playing chess as they were flying into the sun. I wanted to make it into an event. Alex Garland is very much an atheist. He believes that science is our God. So Boyle brought a more spiritual dimension to the script and making the sun a godlike presence in the film.
You do pick up on that, don't you? You do pick up on Alex Garland. Alex Garland, not a big fan of God throughout. That does come across. The only person who's really into God in the movie, also a murderer. So that's very clear.
Yeah, and I think it's a theme Alex Garland comes back to as well, is humans thinking they're God as well, because... obviously, that comes up here. And Ex Machina, I think there's a bit of a God complex going on in that film.
Yeah, doesn't he compare Mark Strong's character? I don't think this was Alex Garland, actually. This was Danny Boyle. He compares him to a religious fundamentalist.
I've got two sets of Danny Boyle quotes here. One is from the commentary, which he obviously did at the time that he sort of just finished the film. And then one is from a book called Danny Boyle in His Own Words by Amy Raphael, which was a few years later, an extended interview. And it's different. It's different.
Pick a different title. Just tell me, Danny Boyle, in his own words, by an entirely different human.
But it's interesting. He's much more honest about this film in that second set of quotes when he's had a few years to sort of stew upon what happened. Because this film took a year to set up. It took almost a year to film. And then it was over a year in post-production. And Danny Boyle did not enjoy making it. One of the difficulties, he said, was 2001, Solaris and Alien. He said those films were a big obstacle. They're titans hovering above you. You can't avoid them and you're constantly bumping into them. And it's difficult to step out of their shadow. So he felt that a lot of pressure in that respect.
Did he not also Event Horizon, I think he put on that list. Surely. He was like, I don't know that I should be making this film because the behemoth that is Event Horizon, the perfect space movie, does bear an uncanny resemblance to my film, which is always going to be the lesser of the two.
Yeah, the four titans, 2001, Solaris, Alien and Event Horizon. but yeah, this is my last quote from him before we get into the film. He said, sunshine drove me mad. It was insane. We arrived before the sun rose. We left after it set. It was eternal night. And she asks, was this the hardest film you ever directed? And he says, by a long, long way. So
I don't understand the quote. So he did a full day's work. I don't understand. What does that mean? They did 12 hours work a day. Is that what you're saying?
But at night. They did it at night. He never saw the sun. And imagine making a movie about the sun, but not seeing the sun.
Well, that's enough to drive you mad. That's insane. That's crazy. All right, okay.
It's the sun that drives you mad in the movie, and yet he was going mad not seeing the sun. How do you make a movie like in those circumstances?
I don't know.
So let's talk about Sunshine. We start with an Alex Zane favourite mentioned in the first episode, and that is the Fox logo being used in the movie. But did you Alex? Did you notice that they run it backwards here?
No. What?
Yeah,
what do you mean?
Danny Ball said no one notices. Well, you normally go, I think, from the sun into the Fox logo, but here you go from the Fox logo into the sun.
Oh, cool.
But he said because the music is playing forwards, no one really notices that.
What a waste of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
He says that. Well, you're meant to think we're closing in on the sun, but really it's a spaceship.
Okay.
So yeah. It's a little twist.
The wonderfully named Icarus 2.
So talk me through that, because you said to me before, because I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it's called the Icarus 1 for a start, and then definitely not number 2, because it's confusing when they're talking between the ships. But are you like, why do you want it to fail? Why have you called it that? But you said there was a proper reason.
Yes, Danny Boyle says on that commentary, he says the idea of naming it the Icarus was to remind the crew of their humanity and their humility, and that failure was the most likely outcome. Which is harsh.
Okay.
It should be called the Happy or Success Ship.
Success, yeah, success.
Or at least have that fact mentioned. Like, oh, guys, just FYI, this is called the Icarus because we might fuck this up. Not just like have it hanging there as like, didn't no one think to run that past a focus group or whatever.
But the other thing is that they make a point, like Danny Boyle makes a point of having done his research on this movie and speaking to astronauts and NASA, the biggest obstacle that you face with space travel is the psychological impact of being out there on your own sometimes or with a very limited number of people. So surely with that in mind, you give them everything they need to not go mad. And being on a ship about someone who died the closer he got to the sun is a bad call. It's a really bad call. And I know he's like, but I wanted to make it bleak. I'm like, but they wouldn't. They wouldn't want to make it bleak.
No.
So, as I said in my intro, the mission is the sun's dying, we face extinction. The original Icarus project was sent on a mission to restart the sun 7 years ago, but they were lost before they reached it. 16 months previous to the start of the film, a crew of 8 left the solar winter on Earth with a payload that was as big, a bomb as big as Manhattan Island. And the purpose is to create a star within a star. So it's essentially 8 astronauts strapped to the back of a bomb.
That's cool.
And it looks cool when you first see the ship and it's behind that massive solar shield. It's a really nice design.
And let's talk about the crew a little bit. So we've got a very diverse crew. The idea that Alex Garland and Danny Boyle had was that in 50 years' time, only Asian economies would have enough money to be able to send off a ship like this. So we've got quite a multicultural crew. And also he wanted an ensemble. He wanted a lot of equality on the ship. He didn't want any big stars, so he could then kill them in any order he wanted. And obviously one or two of these actors have become big stars, but, you know, there wasn't a name above the title actor in this movie at the time.
Yeah. I think he was told that also Brazil and India would also have huge space agencies by this point in the future. And he went, it's diverse enough. He was like, yeah, I've got my diversity. I don't need any more. We've done it. We've got enough.
So the first person we meet is the doctor / psychological officer, Searle, played by Cliff Curtis. We meet him. He's looking directly into the sun, wearing a pair of sunglasses.
First question. What did anyone do their due diligence in selecting these people? Because from the minute you meet the ship's psych officer, you go, well, he's nuts. He's clearly, he's not well. And this is before anyone else has even gone slightly nuts. You're like, I mean, within 20 minutes, skin is peeling off his face and no one goes, you're probably getting a bit much sun, Searle. Probably stop sitting there, turning the filters off that window. You nutter. You're the psych officer.
Yeah, he's taking a shower in light. He talks about the light enveloping him, becoming him. Yeah, he's going quite mad. There wasn't a psych officer on the Icarus One. There is on one on this one, and he's losing the plot.
It was his job. He should be the one to go, like, do you think that perhaps it was calling the first ship Icarus that made everyone mad? In which case, let's call it something else. That's his job. But obviously he didn't do that because he's nuts.
But that is a problem, isn't it? What do you do if the first person to lose their mind on your spaceship is the psych officer?
In this film, you would just have a vault to kill him, I think.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
See how that goes down? I did want to have a little moan about, well, not a moan so much as an observation about the chain of command. Because I don't know why it irked me so much, but I listened to a very interesting programme on Woman's Hour about what it takes to make a good astronaut. And it isn't individuality, and it isn't even a very particular set of skills. It's the unfailing ability to be self-critical, self-aware, and act as part of a team, because it's the strength of the team is what makes a mission succeed, not having one gifted person who's sort of protected by the others. And I've never seen a less cohesive team in my life as the crew of the Icarus 2. And it made me wonder if they'd done research, because to be a good astronaut, it's been known for a long time that you need to be part of a team. So did they know that, the writers, and disregard it because it's not as exciting? Or did they just not know that? And obviously, because it's a movie, you want to have really strong individual characters instead.
Well, I think I think they did ignore that information if they had it, because I think the idea here is to give each character their area of own expertise so that they can each have their own personal crisis in that area that kind of can reveal their personality and give us a bit of drama every 10 minutes. And I think everyone does get a little bit of business to do as the film progresses.
Yeah, I just thought the captain didn't seem like much of a captain either. Like, a captain needs to be the person that's like, even if we're all individualistic, even if we're working as a team, ultimately I'm in charge. And he didn't seem, what's he called, Kaneda, he just didn't seem very statesman-like or captain-like or in charge. And some of the decisions they take seem to be like a group decision, which is madness. Like, surely that lots of the decisions should be the captain's decision, not what, hey gang, what do we all think?
But isn't it about him deferring to the person that is best equipped to answer the question? Like, the big one is whether they board the Icarus 2, Icarus 1, rather. And he does say, look, the person who is best placed to do this, answer that question, is Kappa, Cillian Murphy's character. Yeah. So I buy it as him. But I think also at this point, you have to remember that Kaneda has looked into the sun once and is already on his way to becoming Searle Mark II because he's loving it. So he really wants to go to the Icarus One because he's like, I want to just do things that aren't necessarily about the mission, because maybe the Icarus One has something to do with the sun, which I'm falling in love with. So I think he's already sort of started to come apart at the seams.
Okay, that makes sense.
Let's establish who the characters are, though, before we get any further. So, as I mentioned, we've got Officer Searle. Next, we meet physicist Kappa, played by Cillian Murphy. We meet him when he's doing a video diary to home, telling his family that he's busy saving mankind. In that scene, he reminds us that it takes 8 minutes for light to travel from sun to the Earth. So if their mission is successful, the sky will brighten up 8 minutes later. That's very important information. Very important for later in the film. We meet biologist Corazon, played by Michelle Yeoh, who is using plant life to create oxygen on the craft. And as Alex said about those psychological effects being very important, they spoke to NASA and they said that, you know, rather than having food in packets as you traditionally see in science fiction, the idea is to get the astronauts to grow and prepare their food and lay it out and then clean it away and clean up. That rhythm and routine is one of the things that helps keep them sane when they're away for a long amount of time. It took Kappa an hour to send his message, and now the solar wind is too strong for anyone else to send a message. So we meet the engineer Mace, played by Chris Evans, who loses his shit, which means we get a scene of Captain America fighting Scarecrow.
But he is. I'm so with Mace at that moment because, like, he hasn't even seen Kappa's message, but we've bore witness to a message to Earth that is, at best, very pause heavy. At worst, just like a mumble through, like he's like, so, mum, God, Dad, you know, me, proud of, are you, I want you to be proud of me. And you're like, there's a dude outside waiting in line patiently. And you're like, so think about what you're going to say beforehand. The solar winds, they're picking up. Mace needs to go, you idiot. I got a bit angry.
You got as angry as Mace. You need to head to the Earth room, Alex.
Did no one did you not think he was really milking that message? It's like, I was, yeah. But the Earth room, I'd quite happily spend a lot more of my time in that Earth room. It's bloody lovely.
It was amazing. I would love to, yeah, to experience something like that. I thought it looked brilliant.
I've got a theory about
that.
So he's
in gardens and then he's near the sea and, oh, go on, Alex, sorry.
Well, no, you were about to say, because he's near the sea, isn't he? And he's, yep. Mace says he loves the waves because they put him in like the gardens. He's like, no, bring the waves back. I want to see the waves like smashing over the sea wall. And he finds that calming. And I did wonder, because of all the characters, Mace is the one who keeps his cool throughout better than anyone else. Apart from that little fisticuffs with Kappa at the start, he's the one who understands what needs to be done. And water is the opposite element to fire, and the sun hits people in waves. So I wonder if there's a connection there that water is his strength, and he's looking at water and he keeps his cool.
But then water ultimately kills him.
Oh,
coolant.
Yeah.
Coolant kills him, Chris. Coolant. Coolant, yeah. Is a coolant. Liquid. It's not water.
We're back onto
coolant.
We're back coolant.
Onto
coolant.
Plays a big part.
Is it not made of water? I don't know. You've got a chemistry A level. Is it made of water or not?
It is not chemically similar to water, and that is why he freezes in it.
No, I know. But has it got water in it? Has it got water in it?
No.
You don't know.
We know that intonation. That's when Alex isn't sure, but he's going to state.
It does not have water in it, for it is coolant.
Okay, fine.
But I like the way those scenes, the idea is in the Earth room, you know, he's seen these visuals. We imagine it's CG, but actually they shot that all for real. They took him to a forest and they took him to the Docklands for the wave scenes. So
the London Docklands.
Chris Evans standing in front of that stuff for real, yeah.
Oh, sure, what a shame.
And rounding out the cast, we've got the navigator Trey, played by Benedict Wong. We've got the communications officer Harvey, who's the second in command, played by Troy Garrity, who is Jane Fonda's son, I discovered in my research.
Really?
What?
We've got the pilot Cassie, played by Rose Byrne.
That makes sense because Harvey, the Jane Fonda's son, he does seem a little bit entitled, which you would be if you were Jane Fonda's son. His character is quite entitled.
No, he just misses his family, which you would do if your mum was Jane Fonda, so.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Although he should have, know a bit more about space, because he'll have watched Barbarella, so he'll know a bit more about space than the rest of them.
Rose Byrne is our pilot, Cassie. Hirohuki Sanada is Captain Kaneda. And then we also see some video diaries from Captain Pinbacker, played by the aforementioned Mark Strong. I think this is probably the second time I saw Mark Strong in anything after that god-awful Guy Ritchie film, Revolver. But he wasn't a well-known actor at this point. And I think it's funny that he's kind of ultimately the kind of villain in this film, because now you know, if you see Mark Strong in a film, you know he's the villain.
Yeah.
But back then, this is pre knowing that Mark Strong is the villain in every movie.
Fair enough.
We didn't have that information. Did you get the reference with his name?
Yes.
Of course.
Does someone want to say it?
Do
you just?
I didn't.
Go on, Vicky. It was your choice.
It was. It's from Dark Star.
Yeah.
Dark Star, bloody Dark Star, and you can hear us talk about Sergeant Pinback in Dark Star on that episode. So they pass by Mercury. That's the first thing that happens, which is beautiful. But like lots of sunshine, it was much better on the big screen than watching it on my TV screen. But
well,
I love it.
Sort of a weird. It's kind of weird because I mean they see Mercury, but Mercury's in silhouette. So, like, you've got the sun behind Mercury and then this little sort of sphere orbiting in front of it. Yeah, I guess so. I think it's more the fact... I mean, it's sort of like, all right, that's Mercury. Are we getting any closer? No.
Maybe you're not the right person for my space mission, actually, I've decided now. You're very ungrateful.
Yeah. Yeah, just leave me in the Earth room with the waves. I'll see you when we get back to Earth. Can I just say... This is the first of many times that the one person, like Chris Evans, is the out and out full on hero in this movie. Every decision he makes is fundamentally the right decision. And every time something goes wrong, it's because people did not listen to Chris Evans. He makes the right call every time. Like literally at this point, like later on when he puts the blood on Cillian Murphy's hand and goes, "This is all your fault, mate. This is all your bloody fault." He's not wrong. It is, because they should never have gone to the Icarus One because they're saving mankind.
Yeah, but this is where the dialogue... I think there's an issue with the structure later when they're like, oh, now we have to go to Icarus One. It's like, but we already decided we were going to Icarus One. So structurally, there's a bit of a flaw there. But the dialogue in this scene to convince the audience that it's a good idea, I think is perfect. Like, two last chances are better than one last chance is a brilliant line. And totally sold it to me. Like I can see Macy's point, but I'm so sold by the idea that if we're going to save mankind, it would be better to have two chances.
Yeah, agreed. But it turns out it was the wrong decision. And Chris Evans, had they listened to him, would have been the right decision because they end up using the original bomb anyway. I mean, hindsight's 20/20, but he was right.
He's such a baby about it, though. The whole film is like, this would never have happened if we hadn't gone to Icarus One. It's like, fucking get over it. Like, it was ages ago. When he puts the blood on Cillian Murphy's hand, it's like, dude, build a bridge. It's done. Like, that is so over the top.
I like it. I was like, yeah, Cillian Murphy, just be better at operating your bomb. Like, you built it. Like, why you didn't know you were going to get two goes. So, like, maybe just do one go really well.
You're right. It is a bit funny when he's like, oh, I want you to run the, Canada's like, run the diagnostic or something and do the sort of scenario planning of, will this bomb work by itself? And he runs it. And he's like, do you know what? Actually, it turns out it probably won't. It's like, would you not have thought to do that perhaps on Earth? I don't know.
Yeah. It's a long way to go. It's like going, is this pub open? Because it's a 200-mile drive. I don't know, but let's set off. And, you know, when we're about sort of 50 miles away, I'll probably go on Google. Oh, it's not open. It's not open.
What a nightmare that would be. God.
Right? That's my comparison to saving humankind, driving 200 miles to a pub that's not open.
So the ship's navigator Trey now manually overrides Icarus and sets some new coordinates. But this new trajectory changes the angle of approach to the sun, which fucks everything up. Their sensors burn up. The ship's now damaged. The hydraulics are screwed. And so they've got to do something about this. And Captain...
Because Trey's not very good at his job. It's the short answer. It's unbelievable. Cillian Murphy can't work his bomb. Trey goes, shit, I forgot to readjust the thing that keeps us alive on this ship. It's like, this crew, like, did you run out of people after Icarus One? Because were they the good ones? And these were the people who didn't quite make it onto Icarus One because they were a bit rubbish, but we've got no one else, we're going to put them on Icarus 2.
Icarus One were the best of the best, and Icarus 2 were the second best of the best.
Maybe.
Right.
And as it turns out, not good enough. They don their gold spacesuits. What did you think of these suits that they have to wear in this film?
Love it. I think they're absolutely brilliant. This is the kind of thing that, honestly, it's these little designs that make a sci-fi movie great, in my opinion. Something that you haven't really seen before. And I think they're really cool. And I believe, I mean, you'll know, Chris, because this is your movie. But I believe that like this sort of went against NASA's recommendations. Like Danny Boyle had all this advice from NASA about what the suit should look like. And he went, yeah, I'm going to make them gold because they look freaking awesome.
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't have. There's a reason the suits look like they look and are designed like they're designed in real life. But he liked the idea of this gold because they do use gold leaf on their shields near the sun in reality. That's what you would use. So he just sort of stole that concept. But yeah. Danny isn't as big a fan of these suits as you, Alex. He says in the book.
Oh, really?
He says in the book, there were so many people involved in making them that when we finally got to the end, they became very, very compromised.
Oh, that's a shame.
I like the fact that he calls them the Kenny suits because they look like Kenny from South Park.
That's they do. and also an interesting thing to note here is that there's been no yellow on the ship at all. Up until this point. And so when we go out and we see them in their gold suits in front of the sun, it makes that sort of image even more powerful. But they go out there.
You do get the feel, because I know that he made them very claustrophobic intentionally for the actors. So the helmets were built to fit a camera inside and they only gave them that little vertical slit to help the actors' performances. And I genuinely tried to imagine, I know you're on a film set and all the rest of it, but being sealed in a suit like that and probably needing someone else to get you out of it when you wanted to get out of it, I think would have genuinely made you feel a little bit nervous and anxious being trapped inside something that big.
Yeah,
no doubt. So they're outside, they're doing their, they're trying to fix the ship. They do a good job of fixing it, but it does cause a fire in the oxygen garden.
This is another point I wanted to see. If there's some things in the script that annoy me possibly more than I can get over, like Trey not being very good at his job, I think is an unforgivable placeholder kind of thing in a script. But the computer, did you think that the computer, so we'll call her Icarus, she's a bit coy? Like, she's like, they're like, Icarus has taken over. Icarus, state reason. She's like, I've taken over. State reason. Well, there's a fire in the oxygen garden. It's like, do you want to tell, when something's on fire on the ship, tell me first. Don't make me have to ask you a question. Then you're like, well, I can't do this because there's a massive fire. Like, it doesn't seem like an alarm system or it's like they're having a conversation with a human who's withholding information on purpose in order to progress the script. And I don't like that.
Later in the film, would you like
example? Sorry, go on, Alex.
No, I was just going to say it's another example of these lot being crap at their job because they go, we're going to lose a communications tower. That doesn't matter. We can't speak to Earth. But it's that communications tower that fizzes in the sun's heat that then blasts the rays into the oxygen garden. So them being flippant like, fuck it, don't need that communications tower, is what causes the fire. It's another really stupid decision by this crew.
Yeah.
Vicky, would you like the ship a bit later in the film to say to them, you know that Mark Strong who's always a villain? He's just got on your ship. He's just gone here.
It's an amazing moment where Kappa's talking to the computer and she's like, but Kappa, you won't make it. And he's like, oh, give over computer, I'll be fine. She's like, but there's another person. It's like, for fuck's sake, dude. When the person gets on board, tell me then. Don't tell me now.
He's the man who disengaged the airlock back in Act 2. So that would have been really useful. Yes, it was manually disengaged. It wasn't an accident. Someone's done that to trap you on that ship.
Yeah.
But it's quite a dramatic scene in terms of the visuals and the music of Kaneda burning up in the sun while Searle is asking
incredible.
Him. Searle's asking him what he sees.
See? Yeah. That's so cool.
He's going to die, though. Yeah. Searle, he's going to die. Ask him if he's got a message for his loved ones at home. Don't keep asking him what you see.
Because he doesn't care. He doesn't care. Yeah. He wants this, like, rapturous experience. I think the stuff around the madness is really well done. Maybe it falls apart a bit when I got annoyed about Mark Strong just talking about men all the time. And obviously that's more my problem. But I think the idea that you can be in communion with angels and with gods is even more terrifying than Event Horizon, which is you're in communion presumably with the devil, but with demons and things like that. I just thought it was mesmerizing.
The bit, you're absolutely right. This whole sequence and Searle going, Kaneda, what can you see? What can you see is a real, like, it's a sucker punch of a moment because for exactly that reason you just said, he is wanting the epiphany that Kaneda is having that he can't have. And his frustration at the end of that, when Kaneda is just so absorbed in his epiphany that he doesn't relay the information to Searle, and Searle looks heartbroken that he never got to know what Kaneda saw, is fantastic.
Yeah. I think the film does a really good job of reinforcing, like, as compared to Event Horizon, if you don't believe in hell and you don't believe in this sort of, you know, in a deity, it's still very scary, but it might not quite have the impact that you cannot avoid the fact that scientifically, not to sound too much like Brian Cox, but we are all made of stardust. So we do have a connection to the sun that's different from a connection to hell, because maybe our connection to hell is a creation, is an invention, or is a fairy tale or a fantasy or whatever. But your connection to the sun, especially for an atheist, is undeniable. So it's really powerful.
FYI, Menswear, the Britpop band, their best single was called Stardust. Just on the Stardust front.
I used to like Menswear.
Right?
Yeah.
Bobby Boy's full of bravado. His girlfriend looks like Bridget Bardot. He got drunk and crashed his car. He is such a superstar.
Oh, yeah.
Stardust, great song.
Should we go to an indie disco soon? Oh,
no. Oh, oh man. Oh, I'd love that. After the break, Chris. After the break, shall we go to an indie disco?
Yeah, we could. Let's go to the break first.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around the duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
This week at Sukarnov.
Me and Luke have been whiling away the lockdown with our usual nonsense on the Luke and Pete Show. Here's a quick taste of the kind of challenges we've been setting for ourselves.
Give us any nation and I'll tell you why they're dirty.
All right, I'll do it now.
Italy. Yeah. It looks like a sexy boot.
There's also a brand new episode of On the Continent, your weekly guide to the sublime and frequently ridiculous in European football. Find it over on Football Ramble Presents every Thursday.
Neymar's responded to this in kind, that they forgot to tell you how to win titles. Then Alvaro has responded with a picture of Pelé with three World Cups going in the eternal shadow of the king.
This reminds me of Stormzy and Wiley. The spikes that they have.
All that and a whole lot more at Stakhanov.
And we're back. And Harvey is now the captain. The shields and the payload are intact, but they don't have enough oxygen to get themselves and the payload to the delivery point. So they have to rendezvous with Icarus One. That's their only hope.
Yeah, but they were going to rendezvous with it anyway. That's so annoying. Yeah. Like, structurally, there is an issue. You were going there anyway. It annoys me. Sorry, carry on.
And this is where we get our next moral quandary, because Corazon reveals that there is enough oxygen, but for four of them out of the seven. They can make it, but only four of them could go.
She's not having that conversation with the new second in command now, Captain Harvey, though. She's having a little sort of a cheeky conversation with Mace, and is it Rose Byrne is the other one. Like, they're having a secret conversation. It all seems a little bit Machiavellian for a crew that is all about diplomacy and debate. They go, I'm going to stand in this corridor rather than announce this, but we're probably going to have to kill some people. Anyway, thoughts?
I'm thinking that now they're not quite so sure about Harvey. I think they've been seeding it into the film that Harvey's got issues in terms of he just wants to get home. I think it's noticeable that scene where they do see Mercury. They're all looking at it, but he's kind of looking at the ground. He's not looking at it. He's not interested in what's around him. I think the idea is that he's thinking about home. And so I don't know if Corazon thinks Harvey's up to the task at this point.
Yeah, so they enter. Agreed.
They enter Icarus One at this point. They make a joke about Alien, so it's a little bit self-aware here that it's all getting a bit alien. Apparently, the dust all around the ship was Cornish pasty dust.
Now,
I thought that can't be true, but he says it on the commentary and it's brought up in the book, so I believe
delicious.
That...
So
Wait. What is Cornish pasty dust as the first point of order? When have you ever... How is that even a sentence? You can't just go, it's Cornish pasty dust. Like, everyone's like, oh, the dust from Cornish pasties.
Have you ever eaten a Cornish pasty, Alex?
Yeah, crumbs. I bloody used to love a Cornish pasty. Like, you get flakes and you get crumbs. At no point have I ever come away from eating a pasty and go, I'm covered in dust. Oh, that was a dusty pasty.
But what's that stuff on your fingers? It's Cornish pasty dust when you finish eating it in the bottom of the bag.
It's flakes. It's flakes. If he'd said Cornish pasty flakes, oh, we can have a conversation, Danny Boyle. Cornish pasty dust, I don't know you.
Well, in this scene, the next thing we see is another creepy video diary from Mark Strong, who says, it is not our place to challenge God. We are Cornish pasty dust, is what he says.
I was going to say, as an atheist, I do feel a very strong connection to Cornish pasties, and it is so powerful to be linked to pasties in that way. Undeniably mesmerising.
I too am an atheist, but Cornish pasties are my god. So a bit of a quandary there.
So they discover that the ship has been sabotaged, and they find the burned up corpses of the crew in the observation room, which is chilling.
Sat in front of an altar of Cornish pasties that they've constructed. It's an amazing scene.
And suddenly more sabotage happens. Their airlock is destroyed. The ships are drifting apart, and they've only got one suit to get back to the ship, which after a bit of an argument, they decide Kappa will take it because he's the one that can complete the mission.
Yeah, and Chris Evans decides that, because it's yet another example of Chris Evans being the Don in this movie. Like, he doesn't even think about himself. He's like, let's get Kappa back because he can use the bomb and save mankind, which is why we're all bloody here.
All right, why don't you and Chris Evans get a bloody room then, Alex? All right, we get it.
Given the option, I would in a heartbeat. You don't even have to ask me twice. I'll book the room. You tell me where.
So we have to do our old sci-fi favourite here, which is a slingshot.
Yay!
The thing that Ben Affleck takes the piss out of on the Armageddon commentary. this made-up Hollywood term. So they've got to travel 20 metres through space at 273 degrees Celsius without suits on. A couple of them do. And it doesn't go well. So in this sequence... In this sequence, we lose Harvey. Harvey just kind of drifts off and cracks up.
You sound like what Icarus would say, like, because she's so weird. She'd be like, "Well, that didn't go well."
P.S. I've got four more suits here if you need them. You just have to ask.
Icarus, so, what are our chances of survival? Oh, gee, that's a question, isn't it? 50-50? I don't know. I'd have to run some calculations.
They lose Harvey, who kind of breaks up in space.
Can we take a moment here? I just want to mention, I think this is such a brilliant moment. His death, bearing in mind who he is and what he wants and his desire to go home and his desperation to survive. The bit, and this is my reading of it, where he's floating away in space, having failed to get in the airlock, and he unwraps the foil from his eyes. I think at that moment, he's expecting to be safe on board the Icarus II in the airlock. And I think you can read it in his eyes when he pulls that back and the terror that he is in his eyes when he realizes he's floating to his death is palpable. Because I don't think at that moment, because he's blindfolded, I think the emphasis there is the fact that he does not know he's not safe at that point. And it's only when he removes the foil that he's like, "Oh my God, I'm dead." It's so powerful.
That is, if that's what it is, then yeah, you're right. I didn't get that reading, but I like yours.
Because you'd be floating weightless in the airlock anyway at that point, so that he would be anticipating seeing Mace and Kappa saving him at that point, and it's not what he sees, and it's so dark.
Mm.
He's portrayed as kind of the coward in these scenes, but I really feel for him, to be honest. I don't blame him for these emotions that he's going through, and it's quite a sad death.
Because that would be like any of us in that situation wanting to get home. But then any of us wouldn't have got through the test to go on a fucking spaceship to the sun. That's why he shouldn't be there. Do your due diligence. You've got a psych officer whose literally face is coming off from sunshine and like a second in command who literally should be the 10th in command on Earth, not on the ship.
The psych officer does get his wish now because Searle burns up in that observation room.
It's a weird thing that it's a death and obviously you feel sad for him, but are you not a little bit jealous? Like, do you not want to be so focused on achieving bliss and you know how to get it and it happens for you and he doesn't look disappointed? That would be dark if his epiphany was like, "Oh, this isn't what I thought it was going to be," but it looks brilliant and what a way to go.
Because also the other way of looking at that is if he wasn't going to have that epiphany, because you're right, he sort of ends happy, but it would have been far darker if they just left a man alive on that ship with oxygen, but limited food and just sort of floating there until what? He chooses to kill himself and end it or whatever. That would have been much darker, but you're right. His is a happy ending. His arc is a happy one of all of them.
And now we've got another moral quandary because two have just died and they realise that if Trey now dies, they can make it to the payload. They've lost the three people that they needed to lose. So it's that question of one life versus the future of mankind. And so they have a bit of a debate about it. I think there's some nice dialogue here. Cassie is the one who refuses, doesn't think it's the right thing to do, but they nevertheless press ahead and decide to kill Trey. But by the time Mace gets to him, he's already dead.
They want their cake and eat it in that scene,
though, don't they?
Because it's like she goes through the thing where she like three of them vote yes, and then we still hang around like her going, I really can't. And you see her sort of like her breakdown, and like you don't need that because at any point Chris Evans can go, "That's it, it's three against one. We don't need to see you having your moral quandary because we've already voted." And yet we sort of hang around like her vote's important just for the emotion of her crying over this decision, which is completely unnecessary.
What, you think it's unnecessary to have that conversation?
It's unnecessary for anyone to care about her vote after three have voted yes, for the scene to carry on with her going, I can't. It's not worth it. Because, you know, it ends with Chris Evans going, "It doesn't matter what your vote is," which he could have said 5 minutes earlier.
And here we've got Danny Boyle ripping himself off a little bit here, because that conversation they have is so similar to the scene in Shallow Grave when they're deciding who cuts up the body. And then when he bursts in and finds Trey already dead, that shot we get of him coming into the room and we're looking at it from Trey's foot is the same in Shallow Grave as well, when we see the dead body in Shallow Grave and they burst in the door.
Yeah. I have a question. So if you've voted to kill one of your crewmates who is pretty much out of his head, unconscious on tranquilizers and sedatives, and you plan to kill him, surely your first idea of how to go about that isn't a fucking scalpel.
Yeah, surely that's you what go, I thought.
I'll probably overdose him with something while he's already out. You know, I'll put an excess of something in his body. I'll just overdose him on tranquilizers and give him a peaceful death. Not Chris Evans. He goes, all right then, it's slicing and dicing time. Where are you, Trey, you bastard?
Well, it's this true, is because Rose Byrne even says, "Oh, give him a show him a kindness," and it's like, "Yeah, no problem," because he's already hopped up on medicine, so we'll just crank that up a notch, and he will slip away into the night, no problem. I'll tell you what, I'm going to stab him to death.
they even go. What? How are you going to do it, Chris Evans? And he goes, "That's between me and Trey." I bet it bloody is, because anyone else would have gone, "Don't, you're not going to stab him, though, are you?" No, definitely not. Definitely. Are there scalpels in there? Why? Just another reason. Just no, I don't know, because I'm going to stab him. I just like collecting scalpels. But they're in there, are they? Brilliant.
Well, this is when the film starts going off the rails, because this is when it turns into horror, because I think the idea for that is to show that there are two of the scalpels missing when he opens the drawer. Yeah. Yeah. And we learn that, as Vicky mentioned, the ship's computer tells Kappa that there's 5 crew members still on board, which means Pinbacker is there. So Pinbacker has stolen the knives and has slit Trey's wrists himself. And so...
Is that your reading
there.
Of that?
Yeah, 100%.
Oh, it's definitely what's happened. So Pinbacker killed Trey.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought Trey... I honestly didn't see that. I thought Trey had taken his own life.
I don't think they make it clear enough. But,
no, they don't at all.
The idea is, that there are knives missing. Pinback has taken them. He's on the ship and he's killed Trey. He starts killing all of them, to be honest. And so, we're about 1 hour and 10 minutes into the film, a film that I've loved until this point. And I do think it kind of falls apart from this point onwards. In the book, Danny Boyle says this section was criticized because of the execution of Pinbacker. Not Mark Strong's performance, but the way I directed it. People thought it was a shift into something too much like a horror film. Whereas the first 2/3 of the film is actually procedural, hardcore sci-fi with realistic deaths and issues. I love doing that shift. We did something similar in 28 Days Later. Mm. Can you give yourself over to this?
I don't mind the shift at all. I think it's flawed, but not for the reason that it shifts into horror territory. I'm totally with the shift. I think it's fine that Mark Strong turns up and starts killing people. I think it gives for an action-packed sort of climax, running scared on a ship. I'd rather that than sort of some philosophical musings that take us into the very end. But I do think there are issues with it, which we'll get to. But what do you guys think?
I like it. The first time I saw this film, I thought Mark Strong was actually an angel. And so it gave it another dimension of not only is he like a horror baddie, but he's an angel. I thought that he had been completely exposed to the sun and survived, and so was some like a supernatural being. And it's only on this watching that I figured out that he'd just been in the altar room for too long, and that's why he's got no skin left. But he is a person that is alive, and so he's much more of a normal baddie. But I still liked it. I think what you are suggesting, maybe, is that the actual shots of him are frustrating because you don't see enough of him. You don't see enough of what he looks like underneath all that gooey skin. And I would like to have seen that, maybe.
Really? I think it kind of works not seeing him. I think sort of some of the blurring, the out of focus stuff is a bit like, this is a cheat, really, having him shimmering instead of us seeing him. But certainly when Cillian Murphy first finds him lying in the observation deck, and that speech he gives, and he's just like, the light washes him out completely. I think that's a really scary scene.
Yeah.
He kicks off that speech, which is kind of like his Blade Runner speech. He says, "Are you an angel?" Which is a Phantom Menace line from the worst line in the Phantom Menace, which is a strange way to kick off your speech. But in terms of that visual, yeah, Danny Boyle isn't sure that he pulled it off. He said, "I was arrogant. When we did 20 Days Later, I said, leave the zombies to me. And I said the same with Pinbacker. I wanted to make him spectral, a part of the crew's mind. You'd never be sure if he was there or not. He's the argument that goes on inside their minds. But I thought monsters were no problem. I know how to do these. And if you start to think like that, you're not pushing yourself enough. You should always be at the point where you don't know what you're doing." And in hindsight, he thinks he should have used motion capture to get Mark Strong's performance rather than blugging him up and then used mirrors and what have you to sort of make him look like this specter.
Well, that would have been interesting. Yeah, I like that idea. Yeah. Correct, Danny Boyle. Wrong and then correct in your hindsight.
And I think there's also an aspect of Colonel Kurtz as well to the Pinbacker character here, which is something else I think Alex Garland keeps coming back to. There's a Kurtz-like character in The Beach. I think Eccleston's character in 20 Days Later has gone all Colonel Kurtz, and then we've got the same thing here. So he does keep coming back to these themes, doesn't he, of Kurtz and God and or a lack of God in the universe.
Yeah.
So, so he turns out the lights and he's running around stabbing people. Poor old Corazon gets stabbed in the back just as she's discovered the green shoots of hope in her garden.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking. I think it's a great moment. It's really upset. It really upset me. In fact, that was one of the scenes that upset me both times of watching. I think it's great the way she's sort of like taken from the dizzying heights of pure joy to being stabbed in the back.
Cruel. And then we've got a few things going on at once here. So Pinbacker's chasing Cassie around the ship with a knife. Mace is underwater with his coolant. Sorry, under coolant, trying to save everyone. And Kappa is...
It's coolant. No water, coolant.
And Kappa is working on the payload, trying to force the bomb into the sun. And so... you know, we get more and more of Pinbacker talking bollocks. What is it? It says, for 7 years I spoke with God. He told me to take us all to heaven.
I like that. Do you know? I was touched by it. I was moved by it. He just lost me when he was like, there'll be one man left. Oh, fuck off. But the rest of it, I buy that. Definitely.
I just don't think he explains himself sufficiently. Like,
no,
it does sound like a lot of bollocks he's saying. When I think there was an opportunity here for them, for him to explain his philosophy a bit better so that I can kind of understand where he's coming from.
Because he goes from sort of these big philosophical statements to then standing over Rose Byrne's body and going, she fought so hard to stay alive. And you're like, so he's aware of the fact that he's committing murders in a way that is very real and not part of some philosophy that he's doing the right thing.
You're right. If he believes he's like our last emissary and he's the closest thing to an angel that the human race has because of the communion he's had with God, he would have transcended morality at that point.
Exactly.
And he wouldn't want to murder anyone because it doesn't make any sense. And if he did murder someone, he wouldn't know what that is by that point. He needs to be so nuts that none of it is grounded.
But the bottom line of his whole thing, when you sort of pull away all the guff, he wants to stop them sending the bomb into the sun because he's been told by God that actually, who is the sun, that it's mankind's time is up. And the reason sun is dying. Right. Yeah. Okay.
He wants to allow nature to take its course, to run its course and destroy humankind. But he doesn't really explain it in so many words, which I think is a missed opportunity there. So they're now on the bomb. And I found this a little bit frustrating. Some of the visuals here, I guess they're going in all directions, but the gravity's pulling them all into the bomb, no matter what side they're standing on. But the visuals kind of distort and we lose all sense of geography here, so I'm not really sure what's going on.
Which is a fair point. And also it sort of skirts over things that you really feel that you want a little bit of closure on, or it doesn't explain stuff properly. For example, like Rose Byrne is I think she's killed off screen. You never really find out her demise. And also there's a bit where suddenly the bomb is malfunctioning and Cillian Murphy has to do it manually, which is not explained very well at all with any clarity, I don't think. There's a deleted scene that I found, which is actually really good. And you wonder why they took it out. And I think maybe there's a little bit of repetition or they replaced it with another scene because he uses the same line in this deleted scene, which is on YouTube, of going, I spoke to God for 7 years. And it's him sitting on the edge of the bomb, very relaxed, just talking to Cillian Murphy about why he's done what he's done. And Cillian Murphy's over Rose Byrne's body. So, you know, Rose Byrne is definitely dead. And then Cillian Murphy walks away. And Mark Strong doesn't try and stop him at that point, which is kind of strange. And then you first see this idea that the bomb is malfunctioning very clearly and that Cillian Murphy is going to have to manually set it off, none of which comes across in the final cut.
Okay.
And also you get him saying the title of the film in that deleted scene because Kappa says, I don't believe in God. And Pinbacker says, neither did I, but you'll find him in the sunshine.
Yeah. We love that.
I quite like that, yeah.
We love that.
And so Kappa does the business, really. He saves them and stands on the bomb as it's going into the sun and kind of puts his hand in the air as if he's kind of making first contact with something. Danny Boyle wanted Cillian Murphy to cry at the end in this scene, but Murphy had a cold and his tears kept drying up in front of the lights, so they couldn't get that scene shot. And here's something you might find controversial.
I can cry. I've got a cold. On any other day, I'd be bawling my fucking eyes out.
Danny Boyle says of this scene, we tried using the Coldplay track Fix You at the end.
No.
Let me finish.
Okay, carry on.
He says, it felt too cheesy, but boy, did it make me cry. We used Score instead, but we should have gone proper cheesy. You're not meant to like these songs, but they work. When Fix You was at the end of Sunshine, I certainly felt like I'd been moved. So he regrets not using Chris Martin at the end there.
No. It's a Coldplay song that I like as well. I think I love a bit of cheese. You stick Fix You at the end of that, I'd have been bawling my eyes out.
Yeah, it's the sentimental choice, but it is a pretty song and it would have moved me, but I'm equally very glad that he didn't, especially as the score is so good in this film. We would have missed out on that. And then the final shot is of Kappa's sister watching his video message while walking through some snow near the Sydney Opera House. And she's
very
sort of
Planet of the Apes, isn't it?
Yeah, we hear his audio as the sun returns. So we get a happy ending in actuality. And it's interesting, that actor who plays his sister, Paloma Baeza, she's a filmmaker as well as an actress, and she made a series of short films with Cillian Murphy, and she knew Danny Boyle, and she's the one who told Danny Boyle to meet with him for 28 Days Later. So that's how come he's in this film.
Oh, that's a good fact. Wow.
Yes. So there you go. Yeah, that is Sunshine in a nutshell. The only other quote I've got from Danny Boyle is him saying in the book, I spent way too long editing this film. We lost all the feel of Sunshine after a while. So he's not sure he got it. He really nailed this one, sadly.
And I didn't realise. I sort of remember a lot of people talking about this at the time, but it did very little business. I don't even know if it made its money back. I'm sure it probably did eventually, but it wasn't the hit that you'd expect from a Danny Boyle joint.
No, it did okay in England, in the UK, as all his films do okay here, but it didn't really do anything in the States, which is where that needed to happen. So all the goodwill he'd had from his previous couple of hits, kind of he used up with this one. So should we do the bits?
Yes.
All right. Alex, you sound keen. What is your favourite scene?
Okay, my best scene, and I genuinely believe this, I think this is one of, not just the best scene in this film, but one of my favourite scenes of all time in science fiction. I just think it's incredible, which is Kaneda's death scene and the way it's all cut together. So we've got the fire in the oxygen garden and Michelle Yeoh and her attachment to that oxygen garden reminds me of a movie that broke my heart as a kid, which was Bruce Dern and his relationship to the domes of nature in Silent Running. And you really get that relationship. So you've got that going on. You've got Kaneda sacrificing himself, Cillian Murphy going, he's not moving. Why is he not moving? All of that set to it. And you just mentioned it. That score, John Murphy, Adagio in D minor. It's like, I've watched it over and over again after watching the movie on YouTube, which you know I want to do. And it's incredible. I think it's just it's the high point of this movie, and it's just an incredible science fiction scene, full stop.
Mine is exactly the same, Alex.
Oh, is it? Oh,
all I would say is that, you know, I feel like it needs to be seen on a huge screen with a big sound system as well, which is how I got to see it first time. And it doesn't have the same power on the telly, like a few scenes in this film. But yeah, totally agree. How about you, Vicky?
Well, I agree with you that about the Canada's death. It is an amazing scene and it made me feel quite euphoric. But the scene that I was most invested in, the scene where I did the sort of like, you know, biting my fingernails, was Chris Evans's death in the coolant, not water. because he sells the shit out of that. When he drops his wrench earlier in the film and he, without thinking, he plunges his hand in to get it, and you can see how cold the coolant is from just exposing his skin to it for like a second, and it looks like his hand's going to come off, and now he's got to put his whole body in it many, many times. It's really heroic, and I found it really tense, and what a horrible fucking way to die. And then obviously, I know it's an easy contrast, but the contrast of the below freezing temperature of the coolant with the sun, and everybody else gets this rapturous sun death, and the hero gets this freezing, lonely, choking, miserable death. It's brilliant.
Good shout.
Yeah. I mean, he does die. He still does die a hero, though, because
he does, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
And I think, you know, I mean, I think he possibly knows he's going to die anyway at that point.
Yeah.
So it's all a matter of time. But yeah, I do get what you mean.
Yeah.
Vicky, what's your MVW, most valuable whatever?
It's the music, actually, Chris. A joint composition by the electronic band Underworld and composer John Murphy, as we've mentioned. Because even though I'd only seen this film once, there was something on Six Music, you know, like they've got that film music thing on a Sunday. And I walked through the room and I heard a clip from Sunshine, and I immediately remembered the film, having not seen it for however many years. And it didn't really make that much of an impact on me the first time I saw it, but the music obviously did. Because I was like, oh, it's incredible. And then when you watch it again, knowing how good the music's going to be, I think particularly the scenes where we lose the geography, when Kappa is inside the payload and it's really confusing to know where he is and what he's doing, it's the music that gets you through those scenes, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Danny Ball said of that track, the John Murphy track, he said, I think he had that tune for a long time as waiting for the right moment to use it. So he was saving that one for this film, and Danny Ball calls it proper big scoring.
Yeah.
Alex, MBW?
It was the same as Victoria, actually. I think that the score to Sunshine is incredible, and what I picked for my best scene, I don't know that Kaneda's death would be quite so impactful were it not for John Murphy, Adagio in D minor. So I'm going to pick something else. Chris Evans is my MVW. And I think I said this on the Knives Out episode as well, but watching him in a film like this makes you so happy that Captain America has been retired from the MCU now, so he can get back to making other films, because he's brilliant. And he's great as Captain America. Obviously, I love him, but it's great to see him stretch himself as an actor and give different performances. And it's nice to have him back.
Alex, obviously, we record about a week in advance, but you obviously haven't seen the Twitter news this week that Chris Evans might be returning as Captain America.
Oh, for God's sake!
Yeah.
What?
So basically, word's gone round. Someone said that they're trying to figure out a way to bring him back. They don't know how yet. And he then tweeted news to me with sort of a shrug. So this might have all changed by the time this show goes live, but there is a chance he is back. So I'm sorry. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news, Alex.
Oh, does anyone die in the MCU, really? When's Tony Stark coming back in from another dimension, for God's sake?
My MVW, I don't think this is the best work by anyone involved in this movie, but we were nearly 3 for 3, Alex, until you changed your mind. Mine is Adagio in D minor by John Murphy.
Wow. Yeah.
I love that piece of music. I agree with you. It's the reason, a big reason that's my favourite scene. And it's just a piece of music I listen to a lot when I'm writing. It's amazing. So, change. What would you change, Alex Zane?
Well, I'd get rid of that bloody score, Adagio in D minor. Get Fix You on there by Coldplay. Fucking fantastic tune. That's what you want. Every time there's a bit of drama, bang on some Coldplay. What was he thinking, Adagio in D minor?
And he could have had Yellow. It's about sunshine. He could have used Yellow.
No, actually, my bit is, it's weird because my bit relates to what Victoria said was her best scene. My change is the awful, truly upsetting moment where Chris Evans gets his leg trapped in the coolant and he's going to die. He's going to freeze to death. I do not need to see that he's wearing sandals. He was my hero for this movie. Oh, and he's got bloody sandals on. There's a foot there.
All right, we're done.
There's sandals.
We're done.
All right, now I've got a real one. I've got a real one. I got a real one. I got a real one. I knew you'd hate that. I got a real one. My real one is this. If we're going to see Cillian Murphy's sister and her kids on Earth at the end, having been saved, let's see him at the start leaving a message for her, not his mum and dad. Because either leave a message for your mum and dad and we see them at the end going, our son's done us proud. Or have him leave a message for his sister at the start and then we see her with the kids at the end looking up going, oh, my brother's done us proud. But don't have him leave a message for his mum and dad and then his sister at the end. It's stupid.
I mean, I just took it for granted that was a message to his family.
No, he says, Ali says really soon, he goes, mum, dad.
Dad.
Forever. Okay. Yeah, I agree.
Okay, fair enough. Vicky?
So I'm going to have a couple. Is that all right? Because
yes.
I'm going to say one and then apologise because I absolutely hate within the core of my being that it's Trey's human error that kicks this whole thing off. I fucking hate it. And I think the film lets you think that he's space crazy because he sort of comes back to life when the thing with the airlock happens. So it's like, oh, is Trey responsible on purpose for all of these things? But then when he gets murdered slash kills himself, it's like, no, he wasn't. He wasn't space crazy. He's just fucking shit at his job. And you have to write around that. I just can't have it. But I shouldn't be that rude about a script. Writing scripts is difficult and all the rest of it. And I suppose you just get lost in it. And there is so much else about the script, which is amazing. So the change I'm going to have is there's a moment when Cassie is putting Kappa in one of those giant gold spacesuits and it looked to me like he reached up to give her a kiss and she's in his bunk at some point. So they're close, but we're not quite sure if they're a couple or whatever. So let's just, if we're going to hint at that, let's just go for that properly. And when they're in the payload together, they are, something human is there, like love or lust or whatever it is, but a human emotion to pin us to that moment. And also, I understand why Kappa hasn't got a family because you probably don't volunteer for space missions that much if you've got a family. But it would just give him a bit more to lose. I mean, I know that's really cold, but it's like it's just his mum and dad and his sister, and it doesn't have the filmic punch of a romantic relationship.
So Rose Byrne and Cillian Murphy, you're looking for a space bonk, aren't you? You want a bit of a space bonk in here.
Zero G sex swing kind of thing. I don't see why not. Thank you.
No.
Thank you.
No worries.
It's interesting. Actually, Danny Boyle addresses that in the book, and he talks about the fact that they did discuss a sex scene for those two characters, but their belief was that people wouldn't care or wouldn't want to see that because they're dealing with such a serious issue and such. The drama is so heightened up there that to slow down for a sex scene would annoy people. And so that's why they didn't put one in.
No, serious sex is the best kind of sex in a film when everything's very serious.
And he was serious saying that's why
it's the best in real life. What are you talking about? Let's have an argument. Brilliant. Yep. Now we can have sex. Great.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so bloody angry and serious.
I'm seriously
having sex. There's no joy in this because of the seriousness of it.
Yeah, let's just avoid death together. Okay.
Yeah, with some serious sex.
Sorry, Chris, that's gross. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, sorry. I don't lower the tone. Come on, Victoria. Come on, Chris. Get back together.
My change is that I don't know really how to put it into words, but I just hate that. I hate the stuff that you said you like, Alex, the turning into a horror film, him running around stabbing people like a slasher. I would like that more philosophical, thoughtful ending because I think that's what the film is. And I feel like it's a bit of a betrayal when it turns into an action movie. And that deleted scene is kind of what I'm after, the one you described, but I don't think they nailed it in that scene either. I just think there was an opportunity there that they just let slip. So I don't know what the solution is, but I do not like how this film ends.
Okay.
So, is it? Okay. It's verdict
for o'clock. For the record, I know you said the bit that you liked, Alex. Victoria liked it as well. It's not just me, didn't you? You liked it too, Victoria.
What's yeah, that? Sorry. The end of the film.
Are you still sorry. With us here? Are you thinking about your booze delivery? Is this about the rum that's come in?
I was having a cheeky look. Sorry, I was just. Look, I just thought I could see the DPD van. Can you just not get on my case? Anyway, little update. It's not here. So my rum is not here still, which is a nightmare. Right.
Where is the rum? Okay, yeah. So, Victoria, I mean, you, Chris and I did the movies this week. So do you want to guide us through the verdict?
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
Yes, I will do that. So, okay. Well, we better get yours done.
We've done this before. This isn't a new feature to the show, right? So you sound like you've never done. What's this bit?
I don't know how to do this. All right. Well, I think, Alex, we should get yours cleared off pretty quickly because I think you've got a favourite.
I'm going to say this. There is no better moment in either film this week than Kaneda's death. I know I've talked about it a lot, but it is genuinely brilliant. I massively underrated Sunshine before this watch. It's tense. It's scary. It has some horrible deaths and some interesting ideas. Event Horizon, a romanticism about the film that is sometimes more than the film itself. But I'm going to stop wasting your time. It's Event Horizon. It was closer than I thought, but I am obviously voting for the film that screwed me up as a kid and I still think is a brilliant movie. Paul Anderson's best film and a terrifying journey. And it's Event Horizon. The years Lovely. Have not dulled its power.
Chris?
I thought Event Horizon was terrifying when I saw it at the time. It's a very effective scarer and it properly gave me nightmares. But I haven't revisited it since, partly because I was worried that it wouldn't actually live up to my memories. Now rewatching it, I see that it's a combination of other better horror movies in terms of both the story and the visuals, meaning everything I like was pretty much stolen from elsewhere. But that's also the case with a lot of Sunshine. And you can add Event Horizon to list the films that Sunshine rips off, as we said at the start.
Who's worse, the thief or the thief that steals from the thief?
The thief. And so, but I think Sunshine is more sophisticated storytelling. And I think the visuals are better. I think it asks more interesting questions. So while it most definitely falls apart in the final third, I'm picking Sunshine for how much I love what comes before.
Oh, man. Okay. All right.
So that's
we're finished for this week. So thank you so much for listening. It's a draw. Hooray. It's really difficult. I had really high expectations of Event Horizon, which it didn't meet. And I had really low expectations of Sunshine from First Time, which it obviously surpassed. And I really didn't know which way I was going to go until I was typing up the notes, because I don't think either of them quite reach where they're going. And Event Horizon to hell and Sunshine to heaven. But with Sunshine, it's the script issues that undo it for me, because it does look incredible. And I think the philosophical issues it is illuminating, pun, to me are more interesting and more, they just sort of connect with me as a human being, the idea about we're all made of stardust. But I can't get over the script issues. I just can't. I can't. I mean, I know that makes me a pedant, but I can't deal with it. And I have fallen into the trap of believing that a longer version of Event Horizon might help it. So I'm going to pick Event Horizon.
Yeah!
What, because a longer version might help it? What does that mean? What does that mean?
Let's just ride this wave and not question that, because we're all saved an ugly tantrum on this week's episode, which no one wants. But do you want to explain, Victoria? What do you mean? Chris is going to need
to move on for closure.
All right. I don't think the script of Event Horizon is a problem. I think it feels artificially short. And I think if there was a bit more time to explore the true horror of what the director has tried to show, it would actually be a just genuinely better film than Sunshine. So I'm kind of judging it on like least worst, but not to sound as like mean as that is. The script issues for me in Sunshine are very, very problematic. And my issues with Event Horizon are just like, oh, it didn't quite scare the shit out of me as much as it should. And that's less of a problem for me. So I have to pick it because it's less problematic. Oh, it's all right.
I'll take that, yeah. I mean, I'm just happy that the right film won. So, yeah, I mean, you can say anything. You can say you can say that, you know, you just love Sam Neill when he's all chopped up looking like a Cenobite. That did it for you. That turned you on. It wouldn't bother me, whatever it is.
I think these are difficult times we're living through, and you're my friend and I don't want you to fall out with me. And I think with Chris, I've got a bit in the tank still before he gets really pissed off with me. So I'm just going to take one for the team this week, and hey, I don't want you to be upset.
Don't undo. You've done, that's undermining
that's like
the verdict.
It. Now the truth is out. The truth is out.
you see, the happier Chris gets, the angrier I get. It's a very fine balance you've got going on here.
It was close. It was close, but it sounds like Sunshine has won now, so I think...
No, it doesn't. Event Horizon. Congratulations, right. Event Horizon. Hey, we have a winner. Right. Let's talk about next week. I gave you a clue on Monday's episode. And that clue as to the movies we are covering, which was suggested by a dear Clashbotter to be announced on next week's show, the clue was, the traffic in Australia makes me crazy. let's never relive that moment. The traffic in Australia makes me crazy. Christopher. Next week, you will be covering Mad Max 2, a.k.a. The Road Warrior. A response worthy of this show. All right, don't force it. And Victoria, that means next week you are covering Mad Max Fury Road.
Hooray!
Yep. Those are the movies we are covering on Clash Pod next week. The movies are Fury Road versus Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. Very exciting week. Like both those movies, looking forward to that. That is us done for this week, unless there is any other business. Chris, Victoria?
No.
I
want my rum, so no.
All right, you go get your rum. I'll say goodbye. You can leave. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ClashPod. Back Monday, talking The Road Warrior. Bye-bye.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around the duck.
So if you fancy a sit down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.